In a sense, today's talk is about compassion. There are two questions that maybe spiritual traditions will often try to answer in some form or other. One question is, who are you? Who are we? And the other question is, what do we do? Who are we and what do we do? The two questions. And some spiritual traditions emphasize the first one. They'll show you or help you understand who you are. Other traditions emphasize what you need to do, and they show you and help you understand what to do. And sometimes they say if you discover who you are, then you'll know what to do. And some traditions, like sometimes in the Zen tradition, they say that you discover who you are by your doing. So there's this wonderful interplay between being and doing, discovering who we are, you know, our true self or something. And then what do we do? And some of you might be interesting for some of you to look at your engagement in meditation. And is one of those questions more relevant or more how you frame it than the other? Both are important questions for the Buddha. But I would, in my reading of the Buddha's teachings, I think that he emphasized more teachings on what to do rather than who we are. And in a sense, you know, in teaching the not-self principle, a lot of the emphasis on when the focus was on who we are, was actually more on who we're not, and kind of discarding all the things extraneous, extra stuff that we think we are. And then it's kind of like this mud encased jewel. And so you slowly kind of take away the mud, and then you have something precious inside. And one of the teachings of the Buddha is the idea that each human being is in some way precious or to be cherished. The precious human birth. There's a little saying that gets said a lot in Buddhism. This, have a precious human birth. And the notion that each of us, it's quite appropriate for each of us to cherish and love ourselves is a time-honored teaching in Buddhism. Something about who we are, we deserve, just the nature of who we are, just being human being, that to be loved in some core aspect of who we are. And that capacity to cherish ourselves, to hold ourselves dear, is a very important capacity, because that capacity allows us to have a healthy empathy for others. Because the ability to see that we are dear, then we can see that other people are probably like me. And they also hold themselves dear. They also cherish themselves. So one of the teachings the Buddha said, in realizing that you are dear, you're cherished, and others are dear for themselves, no one who loves themselves would want to harm someone else. Somehow seeing the empathy, seeing our similarity, being able to put ourselves in other people's shoes, then we wouldn't want to harm anybody else. So this is all kind of a little bit pointing in the direction of who we are. But there's something really precious here in being a human being. But that's not always so obvious. So here's a story. In the early days of the Buddha's teaching, all kinds of people joined the monastic order. And, you know, it was kind of, they didn't have a lot of rules at first. It kind of just, it was very open, just come and come being monk. And then slowly, over the decades that he taught, he realized that the various rules were needed in order to keep a certain level of sanity and order in the order, in the monastic order. So he added eventually some 227 monastic rules. But initially there were no rules, and it's some of these people who joined the monastic orders were kind of wild characters. They really needed to join the order. They really needed to practice, and that's often happens in Buddhist communities. Is that it's often the people who have the most need for practice who show up, and that's often because they are, you know, troubled in some way or other. So keep that in mind as I read the story. At a that at that time, a certain monk was suffering from dysentery and lay where he had fallen down in his own excrements. As the Buddha was walking about, he came to the lodging of that monk. When he saw that monk lying where he had fallen in his own excrements, he went over to him and said, "Brother, what ails you?" "I have dysentery." "But is there anyone taking care of you?" "No." "Why is it that the monks do not take care of you?" It's a reasonable question. He's living in the monastery. "I am useless to the monks. Therefore, the monks do not care for me." "I am useless." Then the Buddha said to the Venerable Ananda, "Go, Ananda, and fetch water. We will wash this brother of ours." When Ananda had fetched water, the Buddha poured it out, and Venerable Ananda washed the brother all over. Then the Buddha, taking him by the head, and the Venerable Ananda taking him by the feet, together they laid him on a bed. Then the Buddha, in this connection and on that occasion, gathered the order of monks together and questioned them, saying, "Monks, is there in such a lodging a brother who is sick?" "There is," the monk said. "And what ails that monk?" "That monk has dysentery." So the other monks know what's going on. "But is there anyone taking care of him?" The monks still know what's going on, and they say, "No." "Why not? Why do the monks not take care of him?" "That brother is useless to the order of monks. That is why the monks do not take care of him." "Monks," the Buddha said, "monks, you have no mother and no father to take care of you. If you will not take care of each other, who else will do it? Monks, those who would attend to me, let them attend to the sick. Those who would attend to me, let them attend to the sick." So there's various ways of reading this story or reflecting on it. One way is to reflect on it as if something had happened long ago and we can be outraged. How could these monks, Buddhist monks after all, how could they leave someone sick, laying on the floor in their own shit, and just to consider them useless? And then we could explain it away a little bit by saying, well, there's all kinds of characters in the Buddhist monastic order, and some of them, you know, were pretty undeveloped spiritually. But there's another way of reading this, and that is to personalize it. Not to treat it as something out there that happened long ago. And I would suggest that one of the ways to make it come more alive and rich for you is to personalize it in this way. So there was a monk who was sick, laying in his own excrement, left alone, no one taking care of him. Have you ever been like that? Or something like that? Have you ever been down and out, or sick, or in tragedy, or some kind of difficulty, and there was no one around you to take care of you? Has that happened to you? What's that like? Or have you been, and then the Buddha asked him, you know, what's going on here? And he said, "I'm useless." Have you ever felt useless in some way or other? It's unworthy. Has that been a situation that you found yourself in? And what did it feel like to feel useless, to feel unworthy, to feel like you don't count, feel discounted, to feel like you don't count and you have to kind of just, you know, you don't deserve to be attended to or helped? Or what does that feel like? So in a sense, you know, to see yourself in the monk, what's that like? It's the very opposite of cherishing oneself, loving oneself. Oh, I'm useless. I don't count. I can't ask anybody for anything. I don't deserve it. And then and there's the Buddha and his attendant, Ananda, who decide to help this monk. Go fetch water. And they wash him. And have you ever responded to someone who was sick or in crisis or troubled? Have you extended yourself beyond what's normal? And the idea of, you know, excrement, you know, there are people whose jobs, you know, who sometimes lovingly, nurses who in hospitals who do it day after day, day in, day out. They're taking care of people and cleaning them up. To step into the messiness of someone's life, and what is it like to step in and help? To offer ourselves that level and the messiness, the ugliness of life, perhaps. Why would we do that? Why would we step in and help someone who is useless? And the Buddha called the monks together, and the monks said, well, the guy's useless, that's why we're not helping him. Have you ever treated someone as being useless? Have you ever discounted anyone? Treated someone as unworthy or not deserving your attention? I think probably everybody has, at some point or other, made some kind of evaluation or judgment that, I'll help so-and-so, but, my neighbor I'll help, but the person who lives down the street at the other end of the block is just too far away from me, and I can't extend myself to everyone. Or certain people are discounted, or... Do we consider some people not useful for us? They're not helpful for us, not useful, they have nothing to do for me, therefore I don't have to help them. Does that ever happen to us? Are the people that are useless, are the people that are useful? Is that a valid... Are there other ways of talking about the word useless that maybe resonate more for you? Are you people who you take as being... not deserving. And then the Buddha makes an amazing statement. And it's not so obvious, I think, to maybe a Western audience how amazing the statement is. The Buddha says, monks, those who would attend to me, let them attend to the sick. That resonates with some of the things that are found in the Gospels. I think there are several places where similar things were being said there. But in India, and in Indian Buddhism, the idea of attending or having devotion or worshipping the guru is one of the highest spiritual things a person can do. And there's a lot of merit that's acquired from doing that. There's a lot of benefit. And so people in India, in ancient India, would often put a lot of effort into kind of going and finding the highest, most developed spiritual teacher they could find. And then they would worship or attend to that person, because that was kind of a high spiritual practice to do that. And the Buddha, at least in Buddhist circles, is considered to be, the pinnacle of the highest guru, highest spiritual teacher in the Buddhist tradition. So here then the Buddha saying, well, if you want to do this very important thing of attending to the Buddha, worshipping the Buddha, worship the sick. Someone who's laying there in excrement, someone perhaps who is not going to help support the meditation, the monastery, or not going to teach, or all kinds of things, but kind of useless, helping in the usual kind of ways maybe they should help. If you want to attend to the Buddha, attend to the sick. That's putting up a very high level the idea of help, of supporting someone who maybe are useless. So what's the value of offering service and help to others? Why would we? Why should we? Why is it elevated at such a high level? It's a declarative statement the Buddha makes. If you want to attend me, then you should attend to the sick. But why is that the case? Why is so much benefit that comes from that? So then I want to shift, if I may, to read a very different kind of teaching that the Buddha made. And this is if you were disturbed by the story, then you might also as well be disturbed by this. This is from the Dhammapada. Don't give up your own welfare for the sake of others' welfare, however great. Clearly know your own welfare and be intent on the highest goal, the highest good. Don't give up your own welfare for the sake of others' welfare, however great. Oh, wow. That's something, isn't it? Why would you say that? I mean, that's selfish. Boy, is it ever selfish. I mean, just as if you count as you're better than anybody else, no matter what their circumstances are, that you wouldn't, you know, give up your own welfare for them? Sacrifice something of yourself, after all, you know? Some of us are pretty fortunate. And and then how do we hold these two stories together, these two ideas together? That those who would attend to me, let them attend to the sick. And there's other teaching that says, don't give up your own welfare for the sake of others' welfare, however great. Are they just, two different Buddhas? You know, one Buddha has said one thing and the other one has said something else, and we can't just kind of reconcile them. I think that reconciliation is, bringing these two together is a really important part of the Buddhist tradition. And that is, I think it's very important, this idea of not giving up your own welfare and to hold that in the forefront. But your own welfare is understood to be connected to the welfare of others. So as we do service, as we connect to others, we don't want to give up the quality of our own heart and mind, the well-being of our own heart and mind in that act of service. Our highest welfare is a heart and a mind that's filled with peace and love. That we should be intent on that and keep that in the forefront, or keep that at center stage. And then from that, can we go off and offer, be of service to others? Or could we be in service of others, and in being of service to others, can we do that and find our peace and capacity, compassion and love in that act of service? So the idea of self-benefit and other benefit sometimes can be seen as being radically separated from each other. In the Buddhist tradition, that radical separation is not there. And self-benefit and other benefits, benefiting oneself and benefiting others, are mutually beneficial, mutually arise together, exist together. The more you can benefit yourself through your own spiritual development and growth and freedom, the more then you're available to be helpful to others. With the idea, for example, that if you want to be a lifeguard, the first thing you should do is learn to swim. It's not selfish to learn to swim, right? So the first thing, one of the things you could do is you can learn how to develop yourself spiritually, know how to keep your balance, keep your heart open, keep your peace, be happy, in the context of, and then be able to go off and support and help others. But more interesting, I think, sometimes is the idea of stepping out to help others and seeing that as a practice that helps us find our own peace, our own liberation, and our own freedom. Not to hold these, you know, not to be one or the other. I've known lots of Buddhists who have sacrificed their own welfare trying to help others. And they wore them down. And I've known Buddhists who have ignored others and gone off on long retreats and sat in the jungles, and they were just so radiant and so happy and so delightful, and it was something really off. Because it was just somehow just self-absorbed. Another form of narcissism. When the Buddha made a distinction between three different kinds of people. The kind of person who's only concerned with their own welfare. The kind of person who's only concerned for the welfare of others. And the third kind of person is the kind of person who's concerned with the welfare of oneself and the welfare of others. And the person who is interested in the welfare of self and others, that's considered to be the best situation. To have both interests in mind. To do both. The Buddha once said, "The teachings which I have realized and explained should be well taken up, practiced, cultivated, and repeated, so that this sublime discipline may endure for a long time for the benefit and happiness of the multitude, out of compassion for the world, for the benefit and happiness of gods and humans." So here the Buddha is encouraging people to take up his teaching, the practice of his teaching, not only for their own benefit, but for the benefit of the multitude, out of compassion for the world. The idea that you would practice out of compassion for the world, you engage in practice of mindfulness, you'd sit every day, you'd do all the different things, live an ethical life, do all these things, be motivated by compassion for the world. Kind of built into the very thing the Buddha was trying to teach. And then for the people who had developed a degree of spiritual maturity, spiritual liberation, he said, "Monks, go forth for the benefit of the multitude, for the happiness of the multitude, out of compassion for the world, for the welfare, benefit, and happiness of gods and people. Two of you should not go the same way." So you also, so the encouragement here is not only help people, but also the gods. Isn't that nice? The god needs our help too. It's a different kind of view of, kind of turns things upside down a little bit, and the usual way of relating to gods. So the idea of compassion lays, I believe, at the heart of what the Buddha was teaching. Is that an admonition? Is that an obligation? Is that a burden we have to take on, the idea of compassion? I think if it is, then we haven't discovered how to bring welfare to ourselves, how to support ourselves. Compassion should be something that helps in the process of liberation. Compassion is something that helps us free ourselves rather than to burden ourselves. You find in some of the Mahayana teachings, a little bit different teaching than this early tradition, but Shantideva and the Dalai Lama are great exponents of this. They say, Shantideva, this famous Indian Mahayana teacher, said something like, if all the suffering of the world, now first I want to say I don't adhere to his point of view, so just to have that, but I think still a very powerful statement. All the suffering of the world arises because people have been self-absorbed. All the happiness in the world arises because people have been engaged in trying to bring happiness to others, engaged in the compassionate involvement with the world. So you find the Dalai Lama saying over and over again, if you want to be happy, support others, help others. That's the way to happiness. You don't see that kind of statement in the teachings of the Buddha. It's more self and other are not considered so separate. They're more integrated together. Benefit both self and benefit others. But that the benefiting self and others, we can treat ourselves as another. The compassion should go in all directions. The sensitivity to suffering and the desire to free the world from suffering, that kindness and that love and that care, that I think is one of the most sublime qualities of a human being, is the qualities that will bring happiness and well-being and fulfillment. If you want to be fulfilled, then engage in the world this way. And there are infinite number of ways of doing that. It's not just one way. So could it be that we discover who we are by our doing? And we discover our doing by discovering who we are. The two go together. And that in the doing of care for others, allowing ourselves to feel empathy for others, to use the mindfulness practice to allow ourselves to take in others as well as ourselves, to develop as much sensitivity for how other people are doing, as well as we are developing sensitivity for ourselves, that sensitivity and that taking in others is part of the path to freedom, to liberation, to fulfillment, to having a sense of meaning in our life. So that's about all I had to say today. Do you have any thoughts or comments about this? Yes, Kate?
My question is about the concept of the presence of bodhisattvas that I learned in other traditions. And is that not something you or this lineage talks about?
So the question about bodhisattvas, those of you who don't know, bodhisattvas are beings who have dedicated themselves to become a Buddha. And there's a lot of confusion in the history of Buddhism, because there's so many different kinds of Buddhism, so many different teachings within Buddhism, and it's evolved, you know, it's over 2,500 years. There's a lot of different understandings and teachings about this, all kinds of things that change and shift and all this. And the Bodhisattva is a being, a person who has dedicated himself to become a Buddha, to become fully awakened. All Buddhist traditions, as far as I know, including the Theravada tradition, has this idea that of the Bodhisattva path, the Bodhisattva ideal in it. So there are particular ways of practicing, particular concerns a person would have if a person's idea is that they want to become a Buddha. What it means to become a Buddha differs in different Buddhist traditions. As you can imagine, the Buddha was a founder of a religion. Historically, what happens to founder of religions is they tend to get deified. And so how people see them gets kind of more and more elevated and grand and all that. And that certainly happened in some of the schools of Buddhism, where the notion of what it means to be Buddha has become kind of bigger and bigger and bigger. And the bigger the notion of the Buddha, the notion of Buddha is, the bigger deal it is to be on the Bodhisattva path, to move in that direction to become this grand kind of being. But the very idea of what it means to be a Buddha varies from Buddhist tradition to Buddhist tradition. And so the very idea of what it means to be a Bodhisattva also varies from different Buddhist traditions. But all Buddhist traditions share the idea of a Bodhisattva. Bodhisattva path is there in all the traditions. It's this big topic. It's a huge topic. But you asked, there's also the idea of celestial bodhisattvas, what some people call celestial bodhisattvas. And that is that there are bodhisattvas, these beings, who are very highly developed. They're on the path to Buddhahood, and they've developed themselves, practiced for eons and eons, for a long time, and they're very highly evolved spiritual people, beings. And they are now residing as almost perfected beings in some heavenly realm. And being there, they're available to help us, support us, and you find Buddhists who pray to them and support them and things like that. Yes, please.
The way I heard this story, so to speak, was that bodhisattvas were enlightened beings who chose to come back to live on earth because their own personal enlightenment was irrelevant if they didn't take everyone else with them.
Mm-hmm.
So
yeah.
That it wasn't this high and mighty kind of idea. It was more, you know, we're going to come back and do another round on earth to help everybody else.
Yes. It's a very common idea about bodhisattvas. One notion that exists in some circles is that this being, bodhisattva, is so dedicated to being compassionate service to the world that they're actually going to stay as bodhisattvas, helping others, and wait for their own full enlightenment until a time when everybody else has been fully enlightened first. And this was told once to some Tibetan teachers who had never heard this idea, and they laughed and laughed, and they said, that's so strange, because they had this image of all these bodhisattvas standing at the door saying, "You go first, no, you go first, no, you go first." Because they all had made the same vow, you know, not to get enlightened, to let everyone else get enlightened. But I think this notion that the bodhisattva is someone who postpones their awakening, full awakening, until other people have been awakened first, is kind of a popular folk idea that has arisen in certain circles, especially here in the West, and come in various ways it's arisen. And if you actually go back and look at any of the serious sources in Buddhism for that kind of teaching, they're absent. And in fact, I just read a dissertation on this very topic. And that dissertation went through all the Indian sources that he could find, you know, just across the board, and said, and came to the conclusion. The conclusion of the dissertation was that particular teaching you mentioned, it just can't be found. So that's interesting. Do you want to ask more, or is it more that's important for you around it? Yes. The other, if I may, just something that's important I want to say is that as Buddhism developed, there were different traditions of Buddhism, and as the traditions developed, they sometimes used different words to refer to the same thing. And one of those words is the word karuna. And karuna in the Theravada tradition, the early tradition, really referred to a particular form of compassion that arose, that was developed in meditation practice. And then as Buddhism developed down through the ages, especially into the Mahayana, the word karuna was more and more expanded in meaning until it became primarily, it meant compassion in all its forms. It became the word for compassion. But in the early Theravada tradition, there were a number of different words that related to compassion. And another word that's actually more important that we hardly know about is anukampa. And also the idea of metta. So the if you are familiar with the later Mahayana traditions, teachings of karuna, and then you go back to the early texts and say, well, what does it say about compassion there, karuna there? You say, oh, they don't say very much. Well, these people are not very compassionate. It doesn't have an important role. But what you need to do is to realize that in the Pali tradition, they're using a different word, anukampa. Then you realize they find that actually it has a central place. And then what I said today, this thinking about, you know, that being concerned for the welfare of self and for others, is that's not a selfish thing to be, you know. It's considered, you know, I think it's a very healthy approach. So what developed over time, historically, is a denigration of the early tradition by the later tradition, with the idea that the early tradition was very selfish. And they weren't concerned about about saving everybody else or enlightening everybody, and I think that these kinds of arguments don't really hold up if you look at the texts, and a lot of the kind of the sectarian polemics that have arisen in Asia as people begin looking into it, beginning to dissolve. And it's kind of very exciting to see that happening here in the West, and we're realizing that the various Buddhist schools that held themselves apart in Asia very dramatically maybe have much more in common than was assumed. But yeah, please.
I have a question that's sort of like a technical question about service, and I find it, you know, when you're trying to help people, what was happening for me in a lot of cases is that, like, there's two things. There's one is God. The suffering in the world is so immense, and you know, swallowing every you know, this person or this situation is just, you know, intractable. Or, you know, it's so diverse. It's like, oh, you know, like I never could imagine that was going on. But so in some ways, like I sort of find myself going like, what's the point? You know, you're just making an encyclopedia of suffering that will never be solved, and you're, you know. And not that you would stop doing it, but like that seems like it's hard to get beyond that feeling of like, well, you know, why am I doing this?
Mm-hmm. Just so much, right? It's exhausting. Just think about it, all the people who need your help. The whole world. How many billions are there now? 6 billion? And if you're bodhisattva or Buddhist, then there isn't just the human beings. But, you know, the human beings are just a tip of the iceberg, the number of beings there are. And so, wow, you know, there's 6 billion of humans, and then there's so many more beings. And the idea of saving them all. It's very important what you raise. A lot of people share your concern like that. One of the things, I think, that's why the mindfulness practice is so helpful, because to be weighed down is a form of aversion and resistance. And so if we can use the mindfulness to actually study and see and understand where that clinging or the resistance is and learn the capacity to let go, then we can learn that it's not necessary to encounter suffering and be weighed down. It's not necessary to encounter suffering and resist. It's not necessary to encounter suffering and be burdened by responsibility. It's not necessary to encounter suffering and be afraid. There's all this kind of extra stuff we add on. And the mindfulness practice hopefully can show where the contraction or the resistance is and show how it's extra. So that, then the question is, that's one important area, to understand oneself really well. The other is to have some common sense about how much we can actually do. And to make some kind of evaluation, I think, where we can do the most benefit. And in different people, that answer is very different for different kinds of people. Different people, there's not a right to answer. I've known people, including me myself at times, that have been burdened by the idea that I'm supposed to be responsible for, you know, all kinds of things that they're far away. And we have some responsibility, but often when I see things going on in the world that are great tragedies, I realize that I can't be spread so thin, you know, to be involved in everything. But I'm motivated by that contact with it. It kind of, I feel sometimes the empathy, I feel the concern. And rather than feeling, I can't take care of that, it's unfortunate. But what I can do is be energized by that, be motivated by that, and I'll try to do better in the places where I can do some work. So for example, one of the things that I do is I'm a Buddhist teacher. And so I try to offer my service through teaching Buddhism. So I kind of, in a sense, I try to do it locally. I'll read about what's going on in Darfur or different places and say, well, I'll do what I can a little bit, but it's really important. I can make a difference here. And there's a lot of people suffering here, and maybe by making a difference here, it somehow can ripple out. So I don't know if that was a good answer, but it's the best I can come up with. That, to kind of do the best I can where I can, and don't allow myself to be burdened by what's sort of distant. Maybe there's some wiser answers.
Not wiser. But I would offer a symbol that I use when I'm caught in the same place as our last speaker, which is the image of the airline oxygen masks, which you are admonished by the airlines to use your own before you go about helping those in your row or your children.
Yeah.
And it's tethered, so you're not tempted to try to get to the end of the plane.
Right. It's nice. And if you learn to swim, then you can help both yourself and others when you fall in the water. Yes?
Hi. I'll try and be short. Yeah, it was a good talk. I'll see if I can get my ideas together. Just as when you feel happiness for yourself, you can't help but want to have happiness for the whole world. It's possible to look at it the other way, just as when you really understand your own suffering and your own pain very, very deeply, it makes it very difficult not to try to help somebody else because you experience their pain so intimately.
Right.
So that, to me, is another way of looking at, like, who do you love first? You know, and how does your own experience teach you what to do in the world?
Mm-hmm.
When you think of bodhisattvas, I mean, I see them as archetypes.
Right.
Like the Buddha could be an archetype. And so the bodhicitta, which is the desire to help, is what can motivate me individually to try to bring the whole world to enlightenment.
Right.
Then it's, how do I affect everybody else? And how, like you say, you can't be responsible for everything that you sense going on in the world. But when you teach and you help me or someone else, then I take that. And so we're all bringing the world to enlightenment. That's how I see it.
I think so. I think part of this, a lot of this question, I started the talk by saying that there's two questions: who are we, and who, and what are we to do in this world? And the Buddha focused not so much on who we are, but much more on who we're not. And to study carefully the issue of self-identity, how we hold ourselves, see ourselves. If we can clarify that and kind of liberate ourselves from the usual attachments, the common attachments to self. Self-attachment, a lot of the questions fall away. Because I think that as we kind of no longer cling to this narrow, tight boundary kind of idea of this is me and self, then it becomes much more natural, I think, to respond to the world in a loving way. But also, when we encounter the world of suffering out there, we're not going to be burdened by this sense of extra responsibility that comes when we have a very tight sense, it's up to me. The identity is there. It's much more fluid and transparent and translucent, the whole world of self and other. And, it's kind of like the example given is if you're walking down the street with someone and they trip, you don't think about should I help them or not? You know, should I or should I not? You know, and you just reach over and lift them up, and you don't even think about, there's a lot of people tripping, and I can't help them all. It's something arises spontaneously out of us. And this idea of something arising somewhat kind of fluidly or easily out of us without the burden of self-identity, tying ourselves in knots, is a very key part of this whole process in Buddhism. So there is a self-benefit. The wonderful paradox, in Buddhism, when you focus on self-benefit and benefiting others, but you focus on self-benefit, is that if that is selfish, the pursuit of self-benefit, then it doesn't work. The very focus and on the very ability to bring mindfulness to what's going on inside of us is meant as the medicine to free us from selfishness. And if we're not selfish, then what? And the answer to that question, then what? If we're not selfish, then what? Is an answer which shouldn't be given to you. But rather, it's an answer that should be discovered by each of you as you go about. Discover who you are in the doing. So if you can let go of self-clinging and then encounter the world, what will your response be? And all the different aspects of the world, in all the different situations of the world, there'd be different responses. So one of the responses is, to those of you who'd like to stay today, is to share yourself with our community, with the community here, and meet people you haven't met before, and it's a wonderful thing to have such a large group of people who meditate on a Sunday morning. It should be cherished and valued and appreciated, and to be able to spend some time with each other and talk is a great thing. So I hope that you will enjoy your potluck if you stay. And we are very much privileged today by the presence of a Buddhist monk, Ajahn Pim, and lives at the Cambodian temple in San Jose. And I think it'd be lovely if you want to stay for lunch, if maybe we could serve you first. And so we have a kind of buffet at the table, and maybe a plate or a bowl we can serve you as you go down there. Thank you.